Branch.
Good morning, Judge Sintel. How are you today? Good morning.
Mr. Branch, how are you doing? I know you had a terrible injury a few years
ago. I'm well, thank you, Judge Henderson, for asking. No more water on the brain, hopefully.
I recall we did have an argument against you when you had your injury.
Yeah, with a concussion, so it's actually helped. Time has helped quite a bit. May it please the court, Matthew Pyok is an attorney seated at council table as well. The district court granted summary judgment in this case on Mr. Payne's claims that the D.C. government and individual defendants violated the D.C. Whistleblowers Protection Act and his First Amendment rights. It's the appellant's position that the district court's decision was an error because first the district court found that Mr. Payne did not establish a prima facie case. First, it's our position that it's disputed whether he established a prima facie case, but it's clear from authority in this court that once the employee is subjected to an adverse action and he shows that there's some link between the adverse action and his prior protected activity, the real question for the court is whether the employee can somehow show that there's the reason offered for the action taken against him is false. So this case in some respect is similar to the case that was just heard previously and it's, with Judge Colicatelli as the judge.
It seems to be our term to be employment judges.
Let me ask you though, in this case, there's an 8-month gap. And your argument is you've explained it because this was an effort by the agency to get rid of your client over a year period. What I'm not clear about, though, is that in the reasons that were given by the agency, it relied on, these are my words, not the agency's words, one, eyewitness testimony that your client was handing out his private business cards while he was on duty as the elevator inspector for the agency. And that secondly, he had repeatedly failed to comply with the agency's September policy saying that he had to get prior approval from a supervisor for certain of his actions. Now, those are the reasons the agency gave.
Your Honor, well, for the first set of reasons, those reasons are disputed, as the court is aware. The statements were not under oath, and the hearing officer who heard the initial reasons on why Mr. Payne was terminated discredited these reasons provided by the agency, found them largely not credible, primarily because the statements were not placed on the oath. Now, the individuals who provided these statements were individuals who were actually regulated by the District of Columbia Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs, and Mr. Payne had actually issued fines and citations to these entities that complained to him.
Let me ask, I thought the hearing officer said, and maybe I'm wrong about this, that handing out the cards wasn't sufficient for termination, and she remanded it to the agency for appropriate action. I thought that was her concern, that enough to terminate him, but that there were these violations.
Well, first, I think it's disputed whether he actually engaged in these violations. Mr. Payne has a business, and he operated in Virginia and in Maryland. He notified the agency that he had a business, and he requested the agency's position on whether it was permissible for him to conduct the business, and this is all alleged in the complaint. He never got a response. But the hearing officer specifically found that, first, the offenses that it's alleged that he engaged in were not severe enough to warrant termination for the first offense. And what the hearing officer found was that there were two or three occasions where Mr. Payne gave out his business cards. Now, Mr. Payne's position was that he gave out a business card when he was at a private convention in Maryland. He saw someone who worked in the district, and he admitted on a second occasion during his lunch hour, someone asked him for his business card, and he actually gave out his business card. But the hearing officer found that there was not a sufficient basis to terminate him based on the allegations made against him.
All right, but I guess my only point is the agency said, well, they had these instances when he did hand out his card, and then they had some additional eyewitnesses, maybe not under oath again, but who said that he had handed out his card when he was...
Well, I don't believe that there are any eyewitnesses who provided testimony under oath. The one eyewitness who did provide testimony under oath is being sued in a lawsuit for defamation and interference with
Mr.
Payne's.
Mr. Clark?
That's Mr. Clark in the D.C. Court, in the D.C. Court of Appeals.
I know, but I mean, the point is the agency at the time he was terminated had his statement.
Your
as
Honor.
As well as these other statements. My only point, I just need you to respond, is you want to tie this to his testimony before
yes.
the city council and the statement. Well, not the statement, but the media coverage. But the agency's statement is that he was fired for the card incidents plus failing to comply with this prior approval order.
Your Honor, and I think that it's that's the issue. The district court made a decision based on what was in the record. She concluded, she determined that the motive or the intent of these decision makers, Mr. Payne, and we've alleged in our briefs that there was a pattern of antagonism directed toward Mr. Payne, which really does away with this, the fact that this was 8 months. It was an 8 month period. It's not as though nothing happened during this period. Once he made a report, he gave the television report, the news report, and he testified before the city council, where Representative Councilman Graham, in fact, identified him as a whistleblower. But he testified there. This was in early 2006. The agency waited until November 2006 until they received a decision from the Office of Inspector General, which the hearing officer later said was not corroborated by testimony under oath. 6 days after the Office of Inspector General issued the report, Mr. Payne was summarily terminated from his position without any due process. He's worked for the D.C. government at that point for six years. And not only had he worked for the D.C. government, he was a member of a union. So the agency certainly knew that he had a right to notice, an opportunity to be heard before they terminated him. And they terminated him, summarily terminated him immediately. And after he was terminated, he filed a grievance. And during that period of time, from November 2006 until the second termination in July 2007, he was fighting for the grievance. The parties were actively involved in litigation where he was trying to get his job back, presenting all this testimony and evidence that the agency's activities in terminating him violated his rights under this collective bargaining agreement. At the end of that period, when the agency saw that they would not prevail and that the hearing officer was going to rule against them and order him back to work, it's at that point that the agency came in and said, we're going to, because the hearing officer has said we didn't provide progressive discipline for you, what we're going to do is go back to 2006, find a prior claim that was made against you that you shut down an elevator without the supervisor's permission, suspend you for 10 days so that we can claim progressive discipline, not bring him back to work. They brought him in, suspended him for additional 10 days, and at the end of that period, they issued him another termination. So now saying, well, now we followed, the hearing officer said, you know, we needed to have progressive discipline. Now we can make a claim of progressive discipline. So it was a complete sham, this entire process that brought about Mr. Payne's termination. And for the court, I think the district court's conclusion was that Mr. Payne was terminated because he was a problem employee or he had been a problem employee at the agency for some period of time. Not only
is... You didn't say he had been a pain.
and Your Honor, but the district court's decision actually... there are two problems. First, the district court's decision steps into the place of the jury to decide what the intent was of the decision maker. We don't know what the decision, what, how they came to this conclusion, but so they, the district court ascribes motive and intent in place of the fact finders, but also the district court was wrong. The record contains Mr. Payne's performance appraisals through 2006. Each year he was consistently evaluated as satisfactory to excellent, and we quoted some of the comments made by his supervisors about his conduct, about his performance. There was no issue with his performance until Mr. Payne decided that he could no longer sit by and watch while people were dying, falling through elevator shafts because of life and limb hazards in the District of Columbia, and the elevators not being inspected as they should have been inspected. So we believe that there's an explanation for this gap in time, and the courts have made clear that even though courts generally say 3 or 4 months is the period of time, beyond that, we don't really see a causal connection between the protected activity and the adverse action. But if there's a plausible explanation, and Mr. Payne provided an explanation of what happened, there's no bright line rule that says that we have to have 3 months or 4 months. The courts have encouraged judges to look specifically at what else is going on. In all these cases where people engage in a single adverse action, for example, if Mr. Payne had just gone to Fox News and gave a report, and then nothing else happened, and 8 months or 18 months later he was terminated, I think that maybe the district would have a position here. But all of these other things are taking place, setting up the path, or setting the path to terminate Mr. Payne.
Well, the district takes the position that there was just no evidence as to the whistleblower claim that he was terminated because of his counsel testimony, and that there was no evidence that the district's stated reasons, or the agency's stated reasons, were a pretext for retaliation as a result of his testimony. I mean, he was fighting all these things, but these other things were happening. And your point is that, I guess, is it that these independent events on which the agency relied are so inextricably tied to his exercise of First Amendment rights that summary judgment was inappropriate?
Well, Your Honor, we definitely think summary judgment was inappropriate, but I think we're at one point beyond that, that not only are they tied to this, the First Amendment rights, but also you can separate them from the First Amendment rights. We know it, when he gave this newspaper report, and we have an email from the director of the agency. This is the director of the entire D.C. Department of Consumer and Regulatory Affairs. The next day, calling a meeting with her manager specifically to address the fact that Mr. Payne was, they knew that Mr. Payne was the person who had given this interview with Fox News, and discussing the action that would follow. And Mr. Payne also provided this in the record.
Here's what I don't quite understand, and this, you're more familiar with the record than I, but if you're the head of an agency and you wake up in the morning and there's this either expose in the newspaper or on television, why wouldn't you call a meeting and say, you know, we're going to get to the bottom of this and we're going to do better or whatever?
Going to find out what's happening.
That's understandable. Mr. Payne also stated that his supervisor was not happy that his name was mentioned in the report. But also, if the agency was concerned, then we would expect to see the normal process followed. And that means that if there was an investigation, you would have a recommendation made as part of the investigation. That's what happened here. And Mr. Payne was, instead of given his constitutional rights to due process, they walked him out of the building 6 days later. Then we had a hearing officer making a recommendation that Mr. Payne be restored to work, and the agency on paper restored him to work, but immediately terminated him again.
Let me be clear, though. He got an administrative hearing. didn't he?
Before the hearing officer or before the second termination?
I thought he got two. One was before the hearing officer, Mrs. Kusick. And there was another one before a man.
An arbitrator, yes.
Yeah.
Yes, he
and
did.
And so what process was he denied here?
Well, the process that he was denied was for the when the OIG issued a report, Mr. Payne should have been given, if the agency was going to terminate him, they should have followed the same process they followed the second time. They should have given him notice or make a proposal to remove him, give him an opportunity to be heard, go through the process, and then at the end of the process, they determined that the termination was justified. At that point, he would have been terminated. Here, they summarily removed him as soon as we got the report back from
All right, then he has the hearing before Mrs. Kusick.
Yes.
And she says, essentially, you can't terminate him for these violations. They're not serious enough.
Yes.
And sends it back to the agency.
That's correct, Your Honor.
So now we're moving forward. And what process was he denied after
Well, after he returned to the agency, they never brought him back to work. They brought him back to say, we have the hearing officer's decision. But back in 2006, there was a recommendation of some discipline against you. I think it was a proposed 15-day suspension for turning off an elevator. He found a life and limb danger on an elevator, which could have resulted in someone's death. And he turned off an elevator, and he challenged that decision, and a hearing officer found that those charges should be dismissed as well. He challenged those things when they happened in 2006. But the head of DCRA totally disregarded that and said, okay, we didn't win on this, the removal. We have to have progressive discipline, so I'm going back to 2006, and taking this old charge, the stale charge from 2006, and I'm going to give you a 10-day suspension. And when that 10-day suspension is over, you get a notice of termination, and you're terminated.
Now, what you just said, I didn't realize that the 10-day suspension, when it occurred, and you say that Mr. Payne challenged it, that it was lifted or what? I thought...
He challenged it through a hearing officer, and the charges were not sustained. The hearing officer recommended that the charges be dismissed.
Where is that in the record? I'm sorry to interrupt, but I'm not recalling exactly that either. We've had so much employment law, and it's all running together.
They resurrected it, is what you're saying?
That's correct, Your Honor. They didn't take action on it at the time, and it was only after...
What I mean is, if the recommendation was to reject the 10-day suspension, was that the status of things when it was resurrected a year later? Or was the recommendation that the 10-day suspension be vacated acted on?
I think what happened was, when he was originally proposed for discipline, I believe it was 15-day proposal, and the hearing officer recommended that the charges be dismissed. Okay. Now, when the charges, that was 2006, but in 2007, the director of DCRA didn't do anything other than say that there were charges against you back in 2006, and I'm going to issue a 10-day suspension for that.
So the recommendation to dismiss the 10-day suspension just sat there, apparently, for that year.
For that period of time. I don't believe anything was taken on it until it was. I'm pointing. I have it here.
Okay. Well, unless my colleagues have questions, we'll let you get that. If you wish rebuttal or instead of rebuttal, one or the other, so we'll...
Okay, I will submit it on rebuttal, Your Honor.
Okay, we'll hear from the...
169.
169, okay, good. Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
Unless my colleagues have further questions, we'll hear from the respondent. Appellee, excuse me.
Morning. May it please the court, Holly Johnson for the District of Columbia defendants. It's no secret that after the OIG report came out, the department wanted to terminate Mr. Payne. But there's no evidence linking that desire to terminate with him with his counsel testimony. This court is focused almost entirely on pretext, and I'm content to do so as well. I would like to start by clearing up a few points in the record that I think are important. First of all, there's no evidence that the department should have questioned the reliability of the OIG report finding that Mr. Payne conducted unethical conduct. There's no evidence, in fact, that the OIG relied on statements that weren't sworn. The hearing officer somehow got that idea, but there's nothing in the record here suggesting that. And beyond that, the department's reliance on the IG's methods of investigation, which that's what the IG does, that's what the agency's purpose is, it's not evidence that the department acted with pretext when it chose to terminate him. I'll also note that the hearing officer's opinion about the reliability of the OIG report is completely irrelevant. It came after the fact. It came after the department decided to terminate Mr. Payne. And when the hearing officer questioned the reliability of the OIG report, DCRA reversed the termination and conducted its own investigation where it obtained sworn evidence from eyewitnesses, sworn affidavits, that Mr. Payne had committed the misconduct for which he was terminated. So with regard to the initial decision to terminate Mr. Payne in 2006, there's absolutely no evidence that there was any retaliatory motivation in the first place. Mr. Payne now argues that the fact that he was summarily removed, as opposed to being left on the job while he was contesting his removal, is evidence of a violation of due process. And I'll first note that the due process question is only relevant if the department's method in terminating Mr. Payne shows some sort of pretext, because the question before the court here is simply whether there was Mr. Payne's counsel testimony contributed to the department's decision to terminate him. And Mr. Payne raises this argument that the manner of his termination, the summary removal, is evidence of pretext for the first time in his reply. He's forfeited this argument. But beyond that, it's also completely wrong. He was given, the regulations allow for summary action in cases where the department thinks it's important that someone not continue on the job. And the hearing officer, who I will grant her opinion is not terribly relevant, actually agreed that summary action was appropriate here. So for that's another argument of Mr. Payne's for pretext that has absolutely no merit. The third one is just important to note with regard to the suspension, because there were some questions of fact regarding that.
So here's his case, isn't it, that he was an elevator inspector, and there were all these elevators that hadn't been inspected for 20, 25 years, and people were being injured, person died, and so he testifies before the city council on two occasions. He talks to the media. And the agency has a problem on its hands because the private sector doesn't like this. And the Association of Office and Apartment Building Group complains and says he's shutting down our buildings.
There's no connection between the two. I mean, they're complaining.
But he gets the benefit of all reasonable inferences.
Yes, but
he's put the agency on the spot. All right, they're getting pressure from the private sector to do something about this guy. So first we go through this summary procedure, and the hearing officer says handing out the cards is not enough to terminate him. And then, as you say, the agency does its own investigation, and did I understand counsel for appellant to say that the agency's own investigation went back to this 2006 15-day suspension that an administrative agency official had said should have been dismissed?
Let me give you the order of events, because I think that's...
Well, I wrote out a chronology here.
As did I.
And then, while the investigation, the OIG investigation, is pending, on October 16th, 2006, he gets this proposed suspension for insubordination. Failure to get the prior approval. So that's the 10-day suspension. And then right after that, he's
terminated. I have October 11th for that, but yes.
He's terminated.
Yes, so he gets proposed for a 10-day suspension. Mm-hmm. He files an appeal, and that immediately means that we're talking at least several weeks, and it's the district, so we're probably talking a couple months before you get a decision on that. And while that's pending and there's no decision, the OIG report sustains the allegations, completely unrelated allegations, and he's summarily removed. At that point, everyone stops taking action on the suspension. He's been terminated. There's no need to complete the process of the suspension. Mr. Payne files his response to the proposed 10-day suspension on November 16th, which is almost a week after he is removed. So no action is taken. And then the hearing officer recommends reinstatement, and she starts pointing out what she believes are some flaws in the for-cause removal. And at this point, it's clear the department wants Mr. Payne removed. It has what it believes is cause, and so its solution is to respond to both of the hearing officer's concerns. Her first concern was that the OIG investigation appeared to not have sworn testimony, and again, we don't know where the hearing officer got this idea, but okay. So the department says, okay, is there anybody, you know, we keep hearing these complaints, but so far nobody's come forward with sworn statements. Is there anybody with a sworn statement? And they conduct their own investigation. We don't actually know the scope of that investigation, but they conduct one. They obtain sworn testimony. Well, the hearing officer also was concerned that this was too harsh of a penalty for a first offense. And so the department goes back and gets a conclusion from the hearing officer, and we don't know when the hearing officer for the suspension, we don't know when that hearing officer issued her decision, because
that's... But the decision was to dismiss the charges underlying that suspension.
That's correct. A hearing officer's make a recommendation to the department. The fact that they make...
I just want to be clear.
Yes. It certainly appears, yes.
Firing him on the basis of charges that a hearing officer had said ought to be dismissed.
Yes.
That's one basis.
But I will note this.
I just want to be clear.
Secondly... Yes.
Because he twice violated this September 13th, 2006 order about... you must get prior approval.
No, that's the same thing. That is the suspension.
That's the same thing as the 15-day suspension?
Yes.
All right.
Yes, there's one suspension. It's for insubordination. And I'll note, Mr. Payne, when the evidence on this record, admits that he committed the misconduct for which he was suspended. We also don't know why the hearing officer thought that it was insufficient evidence, because the hearing officer's report is not in the record. All that's in the record is the director's determination that this was, in fact, a serious infraction. And Mr. Payne's attorney has referred several times to the hearing officer ordering Mr. Payne reinstated or ordering the suspension dismissed. That's not the role of the hearing officer. In fact, as the director noted in the suspension as attended was not even required to go through a hearing officer. But my point is that this court is bound by the standard set forth in Johnson to determine whether a plaintiff has established causation sufficient to go to a jury on a whistleblower claim. And Mr. Payne has simply presented no evidence that the reason for his termination was based on his counsel testimony. Yes, the counsel testimony made the department look bad. In fact, pretty much everyone who blows the whistle and creates the type of misconduct, refers to the type of misconduct that can rise to the level of a whistleblower protection statement, makes the department look bad.
What I found interesting was the city council report that says we're amending this, because the typical reaction is for the agency to subject the whistleblower to an investigation, which is what happened here.
Well, I don't agree that that's what happened here. I think the investigation actually took place. First of all, Mr. Payne is not alleging that his 2005 testimony led to any retaliation. 8 months later, after the department gets complaints that it has to do something about, complaints of unethical misconduct, it refers the claim to the OIG. And only 6 months after that does Mr. Payne refer to, again testify before the council. This investigation was ongoing at the time Mr. Payne testified before the council. And he's never claimed that subjecting him to an OIG investigation was itself retaliatory.
I just found it interesting that the city council had noted that pattern of behavior.
Well, yes, but obviously this court needs to rely on the evidence before this case. I do think it's important that this court note Mr. Payne's argument that this court need not go through two steps and that the prima facie case disappears at summary judgment under this court's Brady decision really cannot be applied to the Whistleblower Protection Act. Title VII doesn't have a burden-shifting paradigm in the statute. Courts came up with the McDonnell-Douglas test to allow plaintiffs an ability to get the documents they needed before they were kicked out of court, essentially. And at trial, the burden-shifting disappears under Title VII. And so courts have found that sometimes the burden-shifting can disappear in summary judgment as well. The Whistleblower Protection Act has the burden-shifting paradigm written into the statute. And what Johnson, which is the only case that this court is bound by that has decided summary judgment under this burden-shifting, has held is that a plaintiff must establish both a prima facie case before you ever look at pretext, and then must establish an inference of a substantial question regarding but-for causation. Mr. Payne has proven neither. I have one final just factual note that I want to make on the First Amendment claim. Mr. Payne, I think we both agree, the First Amendment claim is going to rise and fall on the whistleblower claim. There's only one protected activity that's relevant to First Amendment that's not relevant to the whistleblower claim, and that's his speaking to Fox News, which was before the 2006 council testimony. The only reaction of management that he has given is that one of his supervisors, someone who served as an acting administrator, told Mr. Payne, oh, I know you were involved in that report. That's the only evidence of anyone having any reaction to his involvement in the report. And there's no evidence that Mr. Douglas was ever involved in any adverse action. There's no evidence, in fact, that Mr. Douglas was even in management at the time that Mr. Payne ultimately was subjected to suspension and termination. Mr. Douglas was an acting administrator at the time. He may well have stepped down or moved on. There's no causation linking the two.
And Douglas is the one who said, I recognize your handwriting.
I don't think he said that specifically. He said, I know you were involved. I just know you were involved.
Okay. Since counsel for Appellant relied on his brief, apparently, on the question of the individual, cousins of action against individuals, I assume you will also.
Yes, I'm happy to rest on the briefs with that. And I see I have time remaining, but nobody ever accused me of speaking too slowly.
Okay.
Thank you.
Mr. Branch, I'm sure you used your time, but we'll give you back 2 minutes for rebuttal.
Thank you, Your Honor. Your Honor, just responding to a couple of arguments raised by the district's attorney. First, a plaintiff in a discrimination context, whether it's a whistleblower's claim or this First Amendment retaliation claim, can always show an inference of discrimination by proving or raising an issue of the truthfulness of the legitimate non-discriminatory reason offered by the defendant. That's the essence of a claim. If somehow the reason that's being offered by the defendant is unworthy of belief, and we believe Mr. Payne has shown this here, then that entitles the plaintiff in a whistleblower's claim or Title VII claim or a First Amendment retaliation claim. That gives you a jury issue. The jury is the fact finder. It has to decide or weigh the reason being proffered by the defendant and weigh that against the explanation being given by the plaintiff. The assertion that somehow Mr. Payne admitted to these infractions or any of the infractions, I mean, that's not true. He did not admit to any of the infractions made against him. What he did say is that he gave his business card away at a convention. He said that he gave his business card away during lunch hour on one occasion when it was requested.
I think specifically he admitted that he had not gone by the instructions with reference to the elevator ceiling without...
In terms of turning off the elevator?
Yeah, in terms of not going to his supervisor.
He did not go to his supervisor, but Mr. Payne, when he took this job, he signed an oath to enforce the laws of the District of Columbia, and if there was an elevator that posed the risk of someone dying or losing a life...
He admitted that he didn't follow the rules with reference to going to his supervisor, right?
I'm sorry, Your Honor.
He did admit that he didn't follow the rule with respect to going to his supervisor.
He did, but once again, those charges were dismissed by the hearing officer. The hearing officer
have the authority to dismiss charges, or
the hearing officer made a recommendation that the charges be dismissed without prejudice.
Okay.
And that was never that sat there for that year.
That was 2006. Nothing was done until 2007 when they were looking for a reason. At least Mr. Payne's position, when they were looking for a reason to discharge.
I think we have now talked to you past your time again, so unless my colleagues have further questions.
Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Mr. Branch. Thank you, Counsel.
I was going to try to grab a second one,
sure.
But I just got it.
This whole bevy?
Yeah, it's this whole giant.
Does she want this too?
No, no. Luckily, no. I think she wants these guys. I'm just always afraid I'm going to drop them and spill all of the stuff.
Yes.